The last one here, it's not strictly a title for the millennium, but it is a term that is a characteristic, a chief characteristic, in fact. And Isaiah 14 is rest. Isaiah 14, 3 and 7. First, in this prophecy, it's directed rest primarily towards Israel, as seen in the compassion the Lord has on Jacob, and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land in verse 1. And strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. And then in verse 3, and it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service, in which you have been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say. Also, verse 7, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon. Again, the trees being used here for other outside kingdoms that have great regard for Israel during the millennium. And also Jeremiah 50, 34. And ironically, these passages are all found in the, or in proximity, or in the passages about prophetic Babylon in the United States. Jeremiah 50, 34. their Redeemer is strong. The Lord of the armies is his name. That word host means armies. Sabaoth in the Hebrew. He will vigorously plead their case, so that he may bring rest to the earth, but turmoil to the inhabitants of Babylon. And then, of course, this is a prophecy about the destruction of the U.S., and that ultimately, at the end of all of that, the millennial aspect of that is characterized by great rest for the nations. There's no external aggressors. There's no external warfare. There's not even any internal aggressors or crime essentially allowed. And so this is a very fitting title for the millennium, since everything is at rest and at peace, which is, again, nothing like we've ever seen in human history to this point. Roman numeral 4, the chronology of the day of the Lord, which begins at the middle of Daniel's 70th week and extends for slightly over 1,000 years. Just as many events can occur in a single day of human history, even so many events will occur during the day of the Lord. Of course, because the day of the Lord is an extended period of human history, a lot of events are going to occur. So be just prior to the day proper, the day star, Venus, that is, the morning star as a reference to Christ, arises, which symbolizes the return of Christ for his church. And this event occurs just prior to the events of Daniel's 70th week. Revelation 22:16, where Jesus is referenced. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. I am the root and the descendant of David. He's the root of David in his deity. He's the descendant of David in his humanity. God pre-existed David. The humanity of Jesus did not pre-exist David. He is where David finds his ultimate existence, is in God himself. The bright morning star, that is a reference to Venus. And of course, very often, historically, on the horizon, you will see Venus just prior to the dawn of the day. That's why it's called the morning star. That's when it tends to appear. So see, the events of the first half of Daniel's 70th week will come to pass just prior to the dawning of the day. And what we have is, of course, you have the kickoff of the day of the Lord, which essentially doesn't start till the middle of it. But prior to that, the Lord returns for the church, 3.5 years specifically, or about 3 actually before. It's 3.5 to the midpoint. But the day of the Lord technically begins at the middle of Daniel's 70th week. And the first portion of that day is characterized by great tribulation and distress for those living on planet Earth. Isaiah 13, 6 and 9. Again, in one of the passages, there are 5 Old Testament passages. There are really more, but there are 5 distinct Old Testament passages that can be seen, the language of which goes beyond anything that could be existing in the human race even now, or could have happened in the past. This has not happened yet. But you have Isaiah 13, 21, and 47, all reference an entity known as Babylon. But the language of, and Jeremiah 50 and 51 are the other two. And these refer to Babylon. And the word Babylon, of course, comes from the root Babel in the Hebrew, and it means confusion. And it is confusion of every type. But specifically, we know that the ancient Tower of Babel had two wings, a political and a religious. And you have passages, for instance, religious Babylon is seen in Revelation 17, political Babylon is seen in Revelation 18. And there are so many reasons why Revelation 17 and Revelation 18 aren't referring to the same thing, that you have to be really intellectually dishonest or just flat negative to miss them. The passage, and you can review that work. I mean, Revelation wasn't done all that long ago. And the reasons why Revelation 17 and Revelation 18 aren't dealing with the same entities is spelled out very clearly in the notes. But so, you have these passages. Well, political Babylon has a particular form that it assumes, as does religious Babylon. And political Babylon in the last days is analogous to the U.S. of A. Religious Babylon, predominantly the Roman Catholic Church, European Catholicism. Although it exists, you know, all throughout the world, but I mean its head is in Europe there, Vatican City. And so with the U.S., you have these five predominant passages about this great entity in the last days. Also Revelation 18 is the third, is a sixth one. But in the Old Testament, you have these passages. And very much the passage language, it references the day of the Lord, because the day of the Lord is so close by the time this happens. So Isaiah 13, 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. As best I can fix this, the destruction of the U.S. happens in the third year of Daniel's 70th week. You've got basically a seven years through here. One, two, three, that's six. Well, it's not the scale, but that's all right. So you got 7 years, but the first three and about 1 month is about where I fix the destruction of the U.S. You've got some passages that tells you that the word's going to go out and warn people to get out, of the country because God's going to destroy it. And, of course, like Sodom and Gomorrah, most people won't believe it. They'll just stay there and die, and they'll go up in the conflagration. But some people are going to believe it, and they're going to get out, and they're going to be told, get out of the U.S. and go back to the home of your national origin, whatever that is. So they get, you know, a good 3 years to sort of execute this. Now, if they don't, after that time, when the destruction comes, it's too late. So when it says, wail for the day of the Lord technically begins here, at the middle. But 5 months prior to the day of the Lord, a lot of things began to unwind. And a lot of judgments began to fall. And as the day of the Lord approaches, these judgments only intensify and get worse. It would seem largely that the seven bowl judgments, well, not just the bowl judgments, but the trumpet judgments, as you see in the book of Revelation, most of those occur during Daniel's, in fact, the bowls occur all right at the very end. They come in very rapid fire succession. Probably not taking much more than the last year, or maybe less. We don't know for sure. I mean, you can only fix certain things as accurately as you can. Then you just have to, you know, deal with it and move on. But the trumpet judgments are largely dealing with the beginning stages of the fallout of the destruction of the U.S. And there's a great number, you know, there's a bunch of information in there with respect to that and what all is going to happen. Again, the Revelation notes are pretty well up to date. If I did it again, I'd probably change a thing or two, or I got a little more clarity on it, but they're actually pretty good. So wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt. The idea of the man's heart melting is a synonym for intense fear and depression and discouragement, and that all hope is abandoned. And so when the heart melts, you're done. You've got no more will to even fight. That's one of the whole deals. And I don't care if you're a military man or have ever been a military man, when the army is standing around with their hands limp and their hearts melted into their boots, it won't do you any good. You're not going to win. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment. Their faces aflame. And so, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. Also, Ezekiel 33. And so you have, again, all these warnings of great catastrophes. Well, beginning with the destruction of the U.S., the world really takes a head south. I mean, the world goes south quickly after that. Because if you try to imagine even the physical fallout of that, the physical fallout of hundreds, maybe thousands, of nuclear warheads impacting one side of the planet all at once, the massive amount of debris and loss of mass that's going to occur on the Western Hemisphere is tremendous. And one of the things that happens because of all of this, as we know, the rotation of planet Earth has changed. See, now it rotates on its axis around the sun, and it takes 24 hours to make a revolution, for the Earth to make a revolution. But then we're told that the day and the night are both going to be shortened by a third. And so therefore the Earth is speeded up a full third. And it's spinning faster. Well, what effect is this going to have on the environment? What effect is it going to have on all kinds of things? The longer I studied the destruction, the nuclear, the fallout from this. Forget about the radiation that's going to get into the Gulf Stream and travel right around to Europe and all of that. Forget about the massive debris cloud that's going to be caught up in the jet stream. You think they had trouble with those deals in Iceland? Those things erupting and getting up into the jet stream and you couldn't fly? Oh, well, wait till a third of the continent is destroyed, or a third of the world just about is destroyed. The Western Hemisphere is, well, it's going to be, the fallout is just going to be incredible. Same thing with the Pacific Current. We know it runs in a big clockwise loop. Same thing with the Atlantic Current. Does the same thing. And so the water that's here in Florida will ultimately be over off of Ireland given enough time. That's the way it works. And so when that all happens, you're talking some severe, catastrophic things. I believe so many things are going to be affected that they become useless. How is this going to affect the carbon dioxide oxygen ratio in the atmosphere? And if those things get really too far off, engines aren't going to work. You're going to lose power. And you're going to have all kinds of problems. So the great fallout from this is just going to be tremendous. And so the destruction that comes out of this, forget the loss of life. The overall effect on the planet is going to be catastrophic. Ezekiel chapter 30, verse 3. Wail, alas, the day, for the day is near. Even the day of the Lord is near. It will be a day of clouds, a time of doom for the nations. A sword will come upon Egypt, and anguish will be in Ethiopia. And the slain fall in Egypt, and they take away her wealth, and her foundations are torn down. Ethiopia, Put, Lud, all Arabia, Libya, and the people of the land that is in league with them will fall by the sword. So again, a massive catastrophe time for the nations. Joel 1:15. Alas for the day of the Lord is near, and it will come as destruction from the Almighty. And 2:11, the Lord utters his voice before his army. Surely his camp is very great, and strong is he who carries out his word. The day of the Lord is indeed great and very awesome. Who can endure it? The rhetorical question, the answer, no one. No one can effectively withstand it. When God goes on a rampage, see, the world's never seen God on a rampage. They've got no frame of reference for this. They've got no frame of reference when the righteous one of the universe suddenly says, I'm not tolerating unrighteousness anymore. And when he goes on a rampage, it's going to be vicious. And then they won't be standing around singing about the sweet little Jesus boy. Sweet little Jesus boy, he's going to come as a murdering, and we see this, we saw it when we studied the book of Nahum. The Lord is the conquering warrior, the warrior king. When he goes forth to fight, well, you've made a mistake because you brought a knife to a gunfight. That's your first mistake. If you're going to fight against the Lord, you better have some real weapons because he's got all kinds of weapons. And obviously you're in a fight, well, it'd be dumb to fight anybody that was omnipotent anyway. He's got all power. What do you think his odds are of winning? Oh, I'll take that bet. I think his odds are real good. And so the world has no real frame of reference for this, for how bad it's going to get. All the catastrophe that's going to come, they just don't know it, they don't believe it. They like to just stick their heads in the sand and keep us entertained. I don't want to think about this because this is too scary. Well, this is what the reality is, though, unfortunately. And you can also see Amos 5 there, 18 through 20, Zephaniah 1, 14 through 18. Three, the day proceeds with the visible bodily return of Jesus Christ to the planet to destroy his enemies at Armageddon. Revelation 19, 11 through 21. And to give you a real flavor for this, now obviously Jesus, in the hypostatic union, now he has all the attributes of deity at his fingertips and he can use them freely. Part of the kenosis was, in the first advent, he couldn't do that. That was a part of the deal. God the Son had to lay aside the free and independent exercise of his attributes in order to become human. That doesn't mean those attributes weren't still there. They're still there. You see that, say, on the Mount of Transfiguration, when Jesus takes these guys up and he goes up there and all of a sudden his face starts shining like the sun and his garments are glowing bright white with light. Well, if you were there, that would have to be impressive. And we can imagine why Peter freaked out. I mean, you'd probably be doing, what's this? Well, you haven't seen anything like that ever. So the attributes are still there, although veiled under humanity, and still there. But now, in the hypostatic, the glorified hypostatic union, Jesus Christ can do, he's got all the attributes of deity at his fingertips. And so he could just say, you know, die, and they would all die. But no, he wades in there with a sword and slaughters them personally. This is the warrior king when he comes forth, and he's ready for battle, and he's got blood in his eye, and he's angry. And you're going to see the wrath of God poured out on these people, and it'll be a personal slaughter that he does. Again, he could have the angels do it. He has a lot of ways he could do it. But he himself personally wades in. Revelation 19, 11, and I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on it is called Faithful and True. And in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire. He's intensely passionate about God and his plan. That whole flame of fire in his eyes, we understand, you know, you talk about the fire in somebody's eye. They came out with a real fire in their eyes. That meant they were really psyched up for this. They're ready to go. Well, Jesus is pretty psyched too. And he's coming out of heaven to take control of his planet. That has been, of course, under the squatter, Satan, all this time. He has a name. And on his head are many diadems. And he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. See, there's a part of Jesus Christ that remains hidden at all times because nobody can really penetrate the mystery of the hypostatic union. We can talk about it, we can examine it, but you really can't understand it. That what did it mean for God to become flesh? How did that change everything? And what's that union truly like? Where you have two distinct consciences residing within one person. Anybody else, they'd be schizophrenic. But God the Son, this is the hypostatic union. And so he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, a symbol of his sacrifice. And his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in linen, fine and clean, were following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And under that analogy, the winepress analogy, human beings are viewed as grapes that are matriculating and maturing into evil. And so the grape harvest finally comes. You have this evil that keeps growing and growing and growing. And he takes the grapes and he throws them into the winepress. And the juice is extracted from them. This is analogous to the blood flowing out of people. And it says that at one point during the slaughter, the blood flows something like, I don't know, it's up to the horse's bridle. So it depends on how big your horse is, but I'm assuming, you know, the average horse's head when he's in a bridle is, you know, yay high. Could be less, I don't know. Probably it's not a Shetland pony, you know. I'm assuming it's 5-6 feet deep. A river of blood, 5 to 6 feet deep, where Jesus has stomped the guts out of people. Oh, that sounds fun. A day in the park. No, not that much fun for the ones getting it done. And so in this analogy, he throws them in there and he stomps the grapes himself. And again, until the blood just flows unbelievably freely. This is all personal with him now. Now he gets to pretend you'd come to planet Earth and they treated you really crappy and crucified you and did all that, and all you were trying to do was save them. Well, there's a righteous indignation that exists within God for the way his son's been treated and the way he continues to be treated by people. But, largely people ignore it. And it goes unknown right now. But when he finally decides to take vengeance, it's going to be brutal. And on his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders and the flesh of mighty men and the flesh of horses and those who sit on them and the flesh of all men, both free and slaves, small and great. And I saw the beast and his kings and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Bummer, this is their last mistake. You want to fight? Okay. But you're fighting God. And now Jesus comes back. He's no longer the meek, mild little carpenter. Now he's got a chip on his shoulder. And now he's ready to fight. And people, again, have never experienced anything like this. They've never seen it. And to them, it's just, and even in mainline, again, religious denominations, they deny all this, that this is going to happen this way. And the serious thing is, they don't take the word of God seriously. But they've misread it, and misread it badly, as we will see. So while this battle is treated as an event, there is some indication that the final mopping up phase will take some 30 days. Daniel 12:11, as we pointed out there at the end of Daniel, there's an extra 75 days to be accounted for. Well, I mean, if Jesus is going to, you know, it says he's going to sit down on the Mount of Olives. But then he appears to go out to Petra or Edom, where his people are holed up, waiting for the deliverance of God. And he starts slaughtering there and apparently works his way back up through Israel until he gets to the plain of Esdraelon. And that's where he runs into Antichrist and his armies. They were all assembled there. But the slaughter appears, because it asks, you know, one of the prophetic questions is, who is this that comes from Edom with clothes red with blood? What's this all about? And so apparently Jesus starts there with the deliverance of his people and then swings back up through Israel until he finally meets up Antichrist and his armies. The slaughter is just incredible. I mean, it is just, there is nothing but death and destruction in the wake of where he goes. So Daniel 12:11 fills us in that there's some time that this takes. You think, well, Jesus could do all this in one day. Well, he could, but it's going to take a while. If you're going to make that trip, it's going to take you some time on foot. Now, he doesn't have to stop to eat or sleep. So he can just be slaughtering right along as he goes. So Daniel 12:11, from the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. Now, that's an extra 30 days beyond the end of Daniel's 70th week, which is 1,260 days. And so why the extra 30 days? Well, it appears to be this final phase where he returns and the slaughter takes some time. And then, once he does all that, and he takes the Antichrist and the false prophet and he casts them alive into the lake of fire, then once he's done all that, well, the mess has to be cleaned. Well, one of the ways the mess is going to be cleaned, we saw there, is the birds of the skies, the carrion birds, are going to take care of a lot of it. I mean, you can imagine with this slaughter, I mean, they can just sweep right in behind him and become, you know, the street sweepers, as it were. Let's clear this debris up. The birds just come in and eat it, and then they're gone. And so you have this, and then you have another 75 days that's talked about here. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days, which is 75 days more than the end of Daniel's 70th week. So therefore, there's a 75-day mop-up period and cleanup period in here in which the kingdom, before it gets officially inaugurated. And then, you know, like for those of you saw the Lord of the Rings, you know, like they have all this fight and all this slaughter, and then that all gets cleaned up, and then the coronation ceremony comes for the king. And that's what you will eventually have here on planet Earth. Okay, well, we've got to stop here today because it is our time to observe. Quarterly, we observe the Lord's table. And so this is the day for that. So if everybody will get into place, we will observe this particular ritual.